Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. I'm your host, Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Today, Paul DePerna of EdChoice joins us to discuss results from the EdChoice survey on teacher satisfaction and wellness across the district, charter, and private school sectors. Then, on the Research Minute, Amber discusses a study that investigates the negative long-term effects of reading recovery. All this on the Education Gadfly Show.
This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Mike, wait for the research. You don't know that yet.
Oh, God. Wait.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. You're the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome our special guest for this week, Paul DePerna. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mike. It's great to be here.
Yeah, for those of you that don't know, Paul is the Vice President of Research and Innovation for EdChoice, which is one of the nation's premier school choice advocacy and research organizations. Also joining us, as always, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, well, Paul, I have to say, I always love having you on. It has been a few years, I guess. But you oversee what has become, I think, by far the most interesting and useful survey in American education. You guys are out there in the field nonstop surveying parents and teachers, I think sometimes kids, right, to really gauge what is going on. Let's get into that on Ed Reform Update. So before we get into this latest survey that caught our eye, which was about teachers and comparing some results between sectors, so traditional public, private, and charter, tell us about the survey project in general.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Mike. Yeah. And thanks for the kind words. And it's really a team effort with Morning Consult, our partners who we've been working with now for more than 3 years. And so January of 2020, we launched a monthly tracking poll with Morning Consult of the general public and also focusing and doing a special sampling of parents of school age children. And then as we went on, we started to do some surveying of teachers as well as teenagers that you had mentioned. And so so at least a couple times a year, we'll survey teachers and we'll also survey teenagers about a whole range of issues, topics in K-12 education. And it's something we focus as an organization on school choice issues, but the surveys themselves really should reach, and they do reach into other areas of schooling and learning in K-12. Education.
So we, I follow the poll, and I also follow Mike McShane, who has a great blog at Forbes, one of your colleagues. He's been on many times before here, too. And he had a great piece about how it seems like private school and charter school teachers both like their jobs more and seem happier, maybe experience greater well-being. To be clear, we would love to have traditional public school teachers feel good too. But tell us about these results, both this interesting net promoter idea, but then also about well-being.
Sure. We have been asking teachers for some time now about the degree to which they would recommend the profession to other colleagues, friends, family. And so that's what you mentioned as a net promoter score question, which is really commonly asked in other industries for employee satisfaction, customer engagement, and so forth. So that's something we've adapted for our surveys. And so going back since we started to survey teachers in early 2020, we've seen these sector differences between private school teachers and district school teachers in particular, and charter school teachers oftentimes falling somewhere in between, but tracking a little more closely with private school teachers in terms of being more likely to promote the profession than those public district school teachers. And so that's been a trend that we've been following for a few years now. And then just recently, in this most recent survey of teachers, we've included some questions around personal happiness and well-being, to what extent teachers would say that they feel like they are thriving on one end or suffering to another extreme on the more negative side. And then these school sector differences emerge again. And Mike McShane, he wrote about that a little bit a couple of weeks ago in his Forbes column. And it's something that that just really struck us as a team as we were going through the results, that also is another, instance of these sector differences.
Yeah. And you say, overall, teaching is underwater on the net promoter thing, right? That that 36% of teachers identify as promoters, 41% were detractors, right? And this is what, basically, what's the question? It's about how, okay, here it is. How likely is it that you would recommend teaching to a friend or family member? So that's pretty depressing. But it turns out it's really driven by traditional public school teachers, right? Underwater by negative 21, whereas private school teachers are a plus 34 and charter school plus 42.
Yeah, it is being driven, like you said, Mike, through about, you know, by district school teacher responses, and that's, and the range goes from plus a net promoter score plus 100 to negative 100. So it's really like a 200 point range. And so, but yeah, this time around the end of, and this survey was fielded at the end of April and early May, where we saw private school and charter school teachers more or less having, you know, pretty insignificant differences between those two, but significant differences from district school teachers on net promoter.
Yeah. Now on personal happiness, it sounded like the news for traditional public school teachers was not as bad, right?
Right. And so for, we're looking at, we had a question that about happiness. And we said, to what degree does your school contribute to your personal happiness? And so overall, 78% of teachers said that that their school contributes at least a little bit towards their happiness. And then 28% said that they contribute a lot towards their own happiness. But then when we really see some differences, looking at that contributes a lot response, though, we see some pretty big differences across sectors. And so we see 40% of private school teachers said that their school contributes a lot to their happiness. Only 22% of district school teachers said that they contribute a lot. So there's about a doubling of the proportion of private school teachers who say that. And then charter school teachers is even higher at 45% saying that it contributes a lot.
All right. Well, so this is where we have the fun part, Paul, to say, okay, what might be driving these changes? And I know you're going to say, we don't know, right? We don't have other questions in here to know. But let's spitball a little bit. We get this in here with David. I mean, first of all, could it be some kind of composition effect? In other words, you know, private school teachers and charter teachers, I believe it is fair to say, tend to skew much younger than traditional public school teachers. This is partly because of the way compensation works and the retirement system works, right? So, you know, in the public school teacher sample, maybe you've got a, you know, some group of teachers, 20, 25 year veterans who maybe are burned out, but they're stuck. They got to hang in there because of their pension. I mean, it's, I don't know. Does that make sense, David? Do you think that's maybe part of it? If we compare young teachers to young teachers, maybe it would be more similar.
Well, I'm gonna put that back to Paul and let him take that question. I saw that some of the results were broken down by experience level, right? I don't think it was age, but it was experience level. So, I mean, it seems like that's at least a possibility to look at it that way.
I mean, those are like valid, I mean, I think ideas why there could be some contribution. And we do have those demographics broken out. We didn't break them out in the report itself, but we do have this massive, for people who really like the numbers and to get into the weeds of polling, we have a crosstabs document that we post for all of our polls. And you can go through question by question, looking at all those different demographics. And we break out teaching experience by those who have at least 3 years or less, four to 9 years experience, 10 to 14, and then 15 plus years. And so you can see that as the teachers are more experienced, they do go down a little bit on their on those different kinds of indicators along happiness or.
All right. So that might be part of it, but doesn't explain all of it. I mean, you know, and of course, look, I think all of us here, we support certainly charter schools. I know Paul and I strongly support private school choice too. And, you know, you say, look, see, these are great places to teach in. That could be one analysis. The other one is simply that it is true that private school and charter school teachers who are unhappy are probably more likely to leave. Right. I mean, there is more turnover in those sectors. And sometimes turnover is bad if you're losing people who are really good. And it means that students have to deal with new teachers all the time. But sometimes turnover is a good thing if you're talking about people who are burned out or who are just unhappier or bitter. That can be poisonous to your culture of any organization. And so it's good. We say, hey, good riddance. And again, I feel bad for those teachers who are stuck in the pension conundrum, you know, who really are done, but would be giving up, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of pension wealth to walk away.
And I think, you know, we do ask a question about like just asking the teachers if they've in the last 3 months have considered leaving the profession. And if those teachers are 55 or younger. And again, we do see those differences where it actually, I think this question is more of an indicator of morale as much as anything. And we see these sector differences again, where 55% of district teachers said that they have considered leaving. And then 38% of private school teachers considered leaving. And so, I mean, I think it's, yeah, I think things can be learned across different sectors, but I think, you know, in polls have limitations and to what degree you can interpret the findings. But I think that there are, you know, at least suggestions of like what can be learned about why teachers in the private sector appear to have, you know, greater levels of happiness. They're less, you know, less likely to consider leaving, as I mentioned in that last question. And also looking at the charter sector too, and what can be learned there and what can be adapted back in districts in those arrangements.
Mike, I was just struck by a couple of things. I know we're running out of time here, but you know, first, I think looking at the overall picture, like we said, it's not positive to your point, but I actually personally was at least a little bit heartened. I expected things to be worse in the wake of the pandemic. I mean, just anecdotally, what you hear is that, you know, teachers are just done and they want, you know, they're ready to walk away. And, you know, I've been doing this my whole life, but the profession has changed. And, you know, there's a mild decline in the numbers, but it's not apocalyptic, right? This sort of impact this has had on morale. And I think that's important. I think we don't want to talk down the profession, honestly. Like, and we're in danger of doing that sometimes when we focus on the negative. And I think that we may have been focusing too much on the negative in kind of the last year or so. The other thing is, I was struck, you know, there's also that question about the number of teachers who support these different school choice policies, right? And, you know, it's shocking, right? Like, with no description, or maybe it shouldn't be shocking, but with no real, you know, putting your thumb on the scale one way or the other, majorities endorse most school choice policies, including charter schools, right? Which is not, I mean, it's just a reminder to me, as we do battle with the unions, right, or as the reform movement does, that their public positions are not necessarily representative, right? Something what Paul knows the numbers better than I do, but it's something like 2/3 of teachers, you know, with 5 to 15 years of experience support charter schools, right? And they're simply not represented by the public positions of the people who ostensibly represent them. I don't know what to say about that, except it's nuts, right? That's not indicative. Forget about democracy. That's not even indicative of like a functioning professional association, right? It's kind of, I don't know. It was an interesting reminder to me of just how warped the conversation around this stuff is.
Well, and those unions will say they are democratic organizations, but that is, you know, for better or for worse, right? And just like in our politics writ large, a small group of people who care a lot about an issue can have a much bigger impact than a large group of people who are not paying as much attention. And so there you go. Right. You know, the folks who really worry about the charter, say, charter school or school choice impact on the union, you know, on pensioners, on the education politics, you know, versus people who say, yeah, of course, parents should have choices, like that's just a given.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, and it's interesting when you look at, as David mentioned, the breakouts by years of experience along, you know, those different types of school choice questions. And it really does fall off. As you said, after, you know, those, the year, you know, 50 on the 15 plus years of experience, you know, that there's this fall off in support, but it's still around half still support these types of policies, generally speaking. But for those younger teachers, right, it is much higher in the 2/3 to 3/4 range, depending on if it's that baseline, no description question, or if it's the one with the description. So a lot of food for thought for policymakers, I think.
Indeed. Okay. Well, we will leave it there. Paul, really appreciate you coming back on the show.
Thanks again for having me.
Yeah. Well, Paul DiPerna, again, is the Vice President of Research and Innovation for EdChoice. We'll have you back sometime soon, Paul.
Sounds great. Thanks.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So I'm curious, when you were teaching, an English teacher back in the day, would you have been a net promoter of teaching in public education? Would you tell people that you enjoyed it and they should do it?
I would tell them that it was difficult, that it was tiring at the end of the day, but that if you know why you're in it, which is to, you know, make a difference in even just one child, you're going to meet that goal. You know, I really do feel like at the end of each year, I thought, okay, I kind of reached this kid. It might not have been, you know, all six classes of all 25 kids. I don't know. If you feel like you make a difference in one or two, I don't know. That was enough for me, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that was a yes or not, but it was nuanced and true.
Yes. Very nuanced, Amber.
It was nuanced. It was the truth. It's the truth.
Okay. Well, speaking of the truth, that is what research is about, right? Trying to get to the truth. So what do you got for us on the Research Minute today?
All right. We have a new study out in the Journal of Research on Educational Effectiveness conducted by Henry May and colleagues at the University of Delaware. Man, this is one of these multi-million dollar IES funded studies. I think it was maybe $5 million, I think. Focuses on the impacts of a popular reading program called Reading Recovery. It has been the topic of multiple studies, but Reading Recovery has not been the topic of multiple rigorous studies. So what is it? Well, first of all, I think most folks know, but I'll give you a quick description. It's a widely implemented teacher-led one-on-one short-term early literacy intervention targeting first grade students who are experiencing difficulty learning to read and write. These are 30-minute lessons. They supplement the regular reading class, and they last anywhere from 12 to 20 weeks. The program, and this is the sticking point, it uses three cueing strategies, meaning kids look at the context and visuals around the word and guess its meaning, which is typically found to be a little...
Mike, wait for the research. You don't know that yet.
Oh, God. Wait, should we have kids guess at words? I mean, really?
You don't know that yet. That's why we need RCT, Mike.
You're right.
So...
You know, by the way, this is what we have ChatGPT do, right? That's the whole strategy, is it guesses at words. It just guesses really well, as it turns out.
Trained reading recovery teachers follow a sequenced intervention protocol that involves the child rereading familiar books, which is what got me. If the book's already familiar, don't you already know the book? But anyway, they reread familiar books with teachers taking notes, known as a running record, as they listen to the child read and they record every miscue, which means if it's a word substitution, they insert a new word, they self-correct, or they appeal for help. Teachers then follow various strategies, and I'm sorry, but it does get even dicier here, such as having the child compose a story, assemble a cut-up sentence, and do word and letter work on a wall board. The goal is to get the child reading in the average range of their class, at which point they exit the program. All right. Whew. Random sample of schools participating. That's where they're drawing from. These are funded by these I3 innovation grants. Remember these, investing in innovation. They have a separate sample of non-I3 schools. They have four cohorts of kids in these I3 schools who were in first grade during the 11-12 school year and the 2014-15 school years. And then they've got another cohort of first graders in schools that implemented a regression discontinuity evaluation during 16 and 17, basically because it's a long story, but some of the schools had to participate in the different types of evaluation. So they chose ones that did the RD design. The total sample was around 16,000 kids. They did these pre-intervention assessments, obviously, and then assignment to the program was based on the pre-assessment scores. And then the outcome data was what they call an OS, which is an observation survey. It had six subscales, including letter identification, hearing, and recording sounds. The assessments were administered at the middle and end of first grade. So those are your short-term impacts. And then at the end of third grade, which are your long-term impacts in this case. Reading recovery instructions required students with the lowest observation scores to be selected for the program. And then the teachers were supposed to rank order the kids from low to higher scores until all the available slots were filled. Usually they had about 12 kids fill the slots. Because again, this is one-on-one, so it's expensive. Since the cutoff is not the same singular score across schools, well, they had to do something. They calculated a cut score for each school using a binding score RD, which I've never heard of a binding score RD. But what I did get was they use a fuzzy regression discontinuity design, which means the cutoff point increases the probability of the kid getting the treatment, but it doesn't completely determine the treatment. So that's it's a fuzzy RD design because they didn't have one discrete cutoff point. Okay, like the teachers had to rank order them.
It's like local norms kind of.
That's right. Results. Short-term impacts on first grade observation scores, meaning again at the middle and end of first grade, were statistically significant, large, and positive. 0.77 standard deviation.
Mm-hmm.
But when they look out further for both the third and fourth grade outcomes across both of the waves, the impact is statistically significant and negative. So students who participated in reading recovery in first grade had third and fourth grade state test scores in reading and ELA that were on average 0.19 to 0.43 standard deviations below the state test score of similar kids who did not participate in reading recovery. I'm always like, what does that really mean? It equates to about one half to one full grade level. Impacts did suggest that long-term impacts of the program may be less negative in schools where students begin first grade with exceptionally low scores. Less negative if the kids are doing worse. And then they've got all these hypotheses, and they think, okay, well, one could be that these gains are lost because there's not sufficient intervention in the later grades. But then they looked into that, and they did find that the reading recovery kids actually were more likely to receive additional intervention. That didn't pan out. And another theory is that it doesn't help kids to develop sufficient coding skills. It leads to success with more sophisticated words in second and third grade.
Ding, 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 ding.
That's what I've got.
Wow. Well, look, this is really important. And I don't mean to denigrate, people out there who are trying to help kids. But look, this is one of these areas, maybe the best example of an area where we have pretty good evidence and science on what works. And yet a lot of schools still resistant. Now, we've got this big push for the science of reading. Thank you, Emily Hanford, and many others who have been really drawing attention to this issue, and states are passing laws, and it seems like districts are coming along too. So, you know, this might really change things. Reading recovery, though, we know it uses three cueing. And so what will be interesting to see is if that organization, which is definitely, as we know from Emily Hanford's podcast, you know, has very deep roots in the whole language ideology, is willing to look at this evidence and acknowledge that, hey, we need to do something different here. You know, by all means, a program that pulls kids out, gives them extra help on top of high quality classroom instruction, you know, call it tier two instruction. Is that what the people, what practitioners call this? That's fine. But then let's use techniques that work. And we know phonics, phonemic awareness, decoding the word, that's what works.
Yeah, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's also a significant investment of teacher time here, right? I mean, you would expect to do it.
Right. That's not the teacher. They have these people trained in reading recovery.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Do these 30-minute lessons.
Yeah. I mean, but you would expect, well, you would hope, right, that you would get some sort of positive effect from this level of intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Almost regardless of what you did, right?
Right. And we did see that little bump at the beginning, right?
And I do. It is interesting. I remember when Reading Recovery got the Innovation in Education grant. And I remember scratching my head saying, huh? You know, because it was one of these huge grants that was only supposed to go to organizations with very solid evidence of effectiveness. I think KIPP, for example, got one based on, you know, some of the lottery studies on KIPP. And I guess it is because they had these studies, maybe looking at short-term gains that showed some promise. But I think, you know, it's important for us to learn this lesson. Sometimes things we think work don't work, vice versa. You know, the quality of the study matters, and you got to follow kids for more than a year and see how they do down the road.
Yeah. I mean, what got me, having been trained in some of this, you know, whole language writing workshop stuff, is one of the strategies is to have the child compose a story. I'm like, how in the world is composing a story? Because that's definitely, you know, sort of that whole language approach, which, you know, get kids to, you know, engage, make their own stories, love reading. But trying to compose your own stories is, you know, that's kind of like putting the cart before the horse, right? How can you really compose a story when you don't have a real handle on how to read?
Yeah.
I don't know. Just odd.
Yeah.
The part about revisiting book, well, I was just going to say the part about revisiting books that they're already familiar with was also, that stank to me, right? I mean, take it from the dad of a three-year-old, right? You can memorize a book. It's not impossible, right? I mean, the kind of books they're reading, it's entirely possible that the kids just have the words memorized, honestly, if they're reading them more than once. I don't know, it requires further investigation or whatever, but.
And I'm pro memorization. We should have kids memorize poems, for example, as my 15-year-old son had to do the other day. I was very happy to see that. But that is a different skill, right? I was talking to somebody at a school last week, and yes, it is true. I was in a school. I don't do that as much as I should, but it does happen. And I'm glad I did. And they were saying, you know, look, we think that little kids are bored by decoding, for example. But for a lot of little kids, it's fun. It's like, you know, it's a code. You know, it's like a game. They're trying to figure it out. And they get it. They want to be able to read all these words that they're seeing around them. And so, come on, people, let's teach them how to do it. And also teach them to love reading. It doesn't have to be one or the other.
That's right. That is very true.
All right. Well, good stuff, Amber. Thank you for that one. Even studies that have negative findings are important to share. Perhaps they're the most important.
That is right. I agree.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that is all the time we've got for this week. And so until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.